Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Ronan Peace. Later in the programme, a cosmic kiss 4.5 billion years ago and the planetary union it led to.
Because they retain their integrity after the impact, they stay independent, and eventually Pluto is able to push Charon back off, and Charon then establishes itself as a satellite.
The environmental impact of the act of sabotage that broke the Nord Stream gas pipes in 2022. And prospects of cheap, readily available, life-saving anti-snakebite treatments thanks to AI and chemistry.
We used to search for a needle in a haystack, and now we just make a needle.
The meals that our pre-human ancestors ate, like those ancestors themselves for the most part, and the waste they pooped out after, are long gone. Yet, given our modern taste for meat, lots of it given the chance, and the hypothesis that meat-eating gave some of those ancestors the energy to fuel bigger brains, our past diet is an important evolutionary question. Archaeological evidence of stone blades and animal bones with cut marks hints at butchery back as far as 3.5 million years ago, but that may have just been occasional. Now, though, some pretty extraordinary chemical detective work has managed to track down critical traces of atoms from prehistoric meals embedded in remains recovered from the celebrated caves of Sterkfontein in South Africa. Tina Ludica is the chemist who persuaded the curators to let her try and see what those remains could reveal.
So we have Australopithecus. These are our early ancestors. Relationships are always a little bit difficult and murky the further back you go, of course. So here we have a genus of hominins that lived in Eastern and Southern Africa between roughly 4.2 and 2 million years, 1.9 million years, something like this, in many different environments, quite successfully probably. The most famous specimen is Lucy. So probably most of us have an image in the mind thinking of Lucy. So it's still a rather small hominin species, very ape-like, so already upright walking, but long arms. Yeah, an ape-like walk still, and fairly small-brained. So if I say that, they have, compared to their body size, in relation to their body size, they have bigger brains than modern apes, but much smaller brains than us. So our brains are three times as big, almost.
But every evolutionary story starts with a small step, as it were.
Exactly.
And yes. The specimens you were getting, you're not even getting bones. You're using teeth that were found on the cave where some of these other more famous bones have been found.
Exactly. So we are working with teeth, and specifically with tooth enamel, so the hardest layer, the outside layer of the tooth, which happens to be the hardest material in a mammalian body.
Ah, so that's really survived.
That really survived, exactly. So this is almost just mineral. There's almost no organics in there, and that's why it's so robust. And also during fossilization, it keeps the geochemical fingerprint, basically, that we want to look at, preserved over millions of years in this tooth enamel.
Okay. And so the question is whether Australopithecines were eating meat or whether they were vegetarians. It's not the tooth wear that you're looking at. It's actually a kind of almost like a watermark within the enamel, the chemistry that can give you some clues.
Yeah, that's actually nice put, this watermark. I always call it fingerprint, but yes, like a watermark. So I do not look at any outside structures. I do walk into a collection with my dental drill and take powder off the tooth. This powder I take back home here, and we do our magic, basically. So we know that isotopes, what I work on, the geochemical composition of a tooth enamel, can be preserved over millions of years. What we do here is running nitrogen isotopes on this tooth enamel. So
nitrogen is one of the elements you find in proteins, for example.
Exactly. It's one of the elements found in proteins. It's in all kinds of organics. Nitrogen is a big part of any organic tissue. So in here, in guts, in feces, in fingernails, you name it. And the nice thing about nitrogen isotopes, so the heavy 15N versus the light 14N isotope, is known to record trophic level. So it's actually really easily put. Plants have a low ratio 15 to 14N nitrogen. Herbivores consuming those plants have a higher value of 15 to 14 N, and then carnivores again, a higher value. So it just adds up. So we can measure a number and see that this individual in tooth enamel only consumed plants or did it consume plant eaters.
So you go to South Africa, is this right? You go to your colleagues in South Africa, you say, I want to take some of your precious specimens, I want to drill into them in the hope that I can find out what they are eating.
Exactly. So
was that easy?
It's, oh no, oh my God, no. So it's not easy at all. And this is a year-long project already. So we had this like really well-educated guess that this nitrogen geochemical fingerprint, the watermark, as you called it, will probably be there, but we had an issue of getting to it. So first we had a feeding experiment study. So basically it was rodents and we knew what isotopic composition the feed had, we fed it to. Then the teeth were collected and we ran it and we had results that we wanted to see. So it all made sense. We did
so
this.
So that's just to prove the idea.
It proved the idea, exactly. Because otherwise going in a hominin collection and be like, hey, here I am, I want to sample this, that would always be a no. So we showed it in modern African mammals and a lot of different things. The most boring paper I ever wrote is the lion actually ate the antelope, not the other way around. So these are just things you have to prove over a few years. We started this in 2019 to run the first samples. And then finally, we could show like, yes, this all works. So then I flew down to South Africa, first of all, sampling just non-hominin or non-primate fauna. So most abundant fauna, like a lot of antelopes, saber-toothed cats, for example, hyenas, jackals, and things like this that are quite abundant. And we analyzed them here for their nitrogen isotope composition to prove that we get expected results.
These were 3.5 million year old.
Three and a half million years.
Were they also from the same caves?
Exactly. They're from the same deposits.
So that, first of all, really proves that you can do this over millions of years. But it also, I guess, gives you something to compare the Australopithecine teeth against.
Correct. So this serves the two purposes. So once of all, we have a baseline. We have this food web with, yes, carnivores high, herbivores low. And then we have a gap in the middle where the omnivores should plot, of course. And then we can have an individual with an unknown diet and throw it in there and see where it plots, basically. Is it more like a herbivore, more like a carnivore, or somewhere in between?
And the answer?
One of the main findings we have here is that our seven Australopithecines, so we analyzed teeth of seven individuals, molars of seven individuals of Australopithecus, and they overlap greatly with antelopes, so all herbivores, and they do not overlap at all with carnivores. So with this, we see that these Australopithecines that lived 3.5 million years ago in southern Africa did not consume a substantial amount of mammalian meat, but were mostly plant feeders.
Could you tell any more about what sort of plants they were eating?
Yeah, we analyzed stable carbon isotopes, so different isotopes, the isotopes of carbons alongside. So with a different method also here in Mainz at the Max Planck Institute, we analyzed carbon delta 13C values. And those can tell us if this individual that we measure or this tooth enamel that we measure, if this individual would eat more plants like in African savannas, like grasses, or things like leaves would be have a different carbon value than things like grass, like this elephant grass, for example, that we have a lot in South African savannas or African savannas.
So you can see that as well. So those things don't quite match up with, for example, what the antelopes are eating.
Yeah, so partly. So yeah. Sometimes this is another big finding that we saw with analyzing nitrogen and carbon, that in carbon isotopic values, these Australopithecines actually fall pretty closely to one another. So these seven individuals seem to have like a similar plant-based or similar diet just looking at the plants. But the nitrogen isotopic compositions are vastly different. So we have a higher variation in nitrogen than any other taxa we analyzed. So even if we took all of the different kinds of antelopes and plot them together, they still have a smaller range, which greatly overlaps with our Australopithecines, but still a smaller range than if we look at the seven individual Australopithecines.
So it sounds like they may have been eating plants, but quite a variety probably
exactly.
is the climate changed or season changed.
So there can be a lot of different plants in their diet. And also we see in one of the australopithecines the lowest value we have measured so far in this lab. So even if we look at modern tooth enamel, at modern different herbivores and carnivores or anything right now, we have here one of the lowest values. So I think the lowest values actually we have ever measured. And that is interesting because that also means this individual during the timing of teeth formation ate something with very low delta 15N values. And we can, with our method, we cannot pinpoint down what exactly that was. But some tubers, for example, or legumes can have very low delta 15N values. But also in some environments, some kinds of termites, for example, can have low delta 15N values. And termite fishing might be very important in our own evolutionary history, because if we look at apes today, like chimps, for example, they fish quite often for termites. And termites is interesting because it is an energy-dense resource, actually, which is fairly easy to get. So you need to eat a lot. You need to, of course, have little twigs or something to fish those termites. We don't know, but that is one indication that we have in this new study that maybe termite feeding might have been an interesting part of early human evolution.
I don't know whether when you're doing particularly the measurements, you ever stop and think about this. What really gets me is the atoms that you're measuring were once part of a leaf or a root or something like that that an early human ate, and some of those atoms ended up in these teeth and there for millions of years.
Yeah, and I mean, this method here is, the method itself is not that new. It exists for like 15 years and a little bit more, but to apply it for tooth enamel is extremely new. And because tooth enamel has so little organics in there, we have to use a lot of tricks to get to this. So one of the main things of the method is basically that we clean our tooth enamel extremely well to get rid of any organics that is not really well protected in minerals. And then we feed it to a special strain of bacteria. And these bacteria, actually, they convert N2 into N2O. So they convert the signal so we can directly measure it with the mass spectrometer here in the lab.
Sorry, you're measuring bacteria farts.
That's, yes. Thank you for putting it this way. We are measuring bacteria farts. Yes.
Tina Ludeker of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry. Her sleuthing is detailed in Science this week. Follow the link from the Science in Action webpage at bbcworldservice.com. From human teeth to snake bites. I guess it's because each bite is just a one-off thing that I haven't appreciated they accumulate to tens of thousands of deaths every year and far more disability. The problem is particularly acute in tropical Africa and in India. Snake venom is highly evolved to kill or to paralyse, a horribly effective way for snakes to catch prey. And though treatments consisting of pre-grown antibodies can neutralise the toxin molecules, they're clearly not cheap enough or getting to where they're needed. So, step forwards, some Nobel Prize-winning chemistry. 2 years ago, we spoke to David Baker, who's since won a Nobel, about using AI to design from scratch proteins with a planned function. The examples he described were elegant but of no particular purpose. They were just a proof of concept. Nevertheless, venom expert Tim Jenkins realised the approach was ideal to inventing proteins you could manufacture that would bind and neutralise snake poisons. And he was right.
It is one of the most transformational technologies, if not the most transformational technology I've seen in my time as a scientist. I think it's a complete game changer. We used to search for a needle in a haystack, and now we just make a needle. It's quite powerful being able to go from discovery to a design notion.
I mean, what's it train on, I suppose? What I'm trying to work out is, what do you tell the computer to do? What information do you feed in? What do you expect it to spew out?
Yeah, so I think there's two notions here. One, what is it trained on? Well, painstaking work from many, many scientists globally over many, many years that have come together and experimentally solved protein structures, uploaded them nicely into a database. And that is the meat that has gone into the model that is now allowing us to design our binder's own inhibitors that was created by David Baker's group. And what we can provide there is, say, we've got this toxin of a snake, and we want a molecule, a protein, that binds that toxin at a very specific area that we know will stop it from binding to the human receptor. And so that way we can actually design a molecule with quite a lot of control, which is, yeah, very novel.
So in a sense, by learning from the way that other proteins connect to each other, that's enough information with a lot of training data to say, okay, this is what the venom of the copper or something looks like, and this is the kind of small protein that will then fit into some kind of pocket of it or something like that.
Exactly. Just like we have with ChatGPT, if you make a model large enough, if it's seen enough data, it will also be able to provide answers about things that it hasn't learned, it hasn't been trained on, so it can generalize. And that's the case here as well. It hasn't seen these examples, but it understands the principles of how you could do this.
In a sense, the molecule you've designed is a bit like an antibody that might be made by you or me or by a horse. But is it much smaller? Is it different? Is it easier to make?
Yeah, so it has the same functionality. It does the same thing as an antibody would, in that it binds and by doing so inhibits this toxin's function. It is quite a lot smaller. These molecules are also nicknamed mini binders. They're about a tenth or so of the size of a normal antibody. And that gives them certain advantages. We can manufacture them at scale using fermentation, which is quite cheap, and we can do it large scale, which is important since snake bite is a neglected disease and a disease of poverty. So we need a product that is affordable. And also it makes these proteins very stable. They're quite small and dense, so there's not a lot of things that can go wrong in these proteins. So they're also very stable, thermostable, which helps when you're deploying them to hot areas like Africa.
So you just you design the protein, you then put the gene in it for effectively into what, a yeast or a bacteria, you put it into a broth, you cook it up in a bioreactor, and there you go.
100% correct.
So that fits into the existing industry very
exactly
easily.
Yeah. So, yeah, it perfectly fits into already existing biotechnological workflows. Insulin is produced in the same way, and that's serving a global market as well. So it's that was part of the idea.
And that makes it cheap as well, then?
Well, that's what we hope and expect.
Okay, that's a bit you have to test out still, the real-life market. Molecule you've designed, it's a protein you've designed, is that specific against a particular toxin, or will it work for lots of snake venoms, or are there ways of just tweaking it?
Very nice question. So one of the big challenges with snake bite is that there's so many different toxins. Each snake can have several different toxins, tens of different toxins, if we look at it snake by snake. But if we look at it globally, a lot of these are very similar. A cobra in Africa might have nearly the same toxin as a cobra in India. And so we just wanted to see, can we make inhibitors for certain types of toxins? And we were able to show this for neurotoxins that shut down your nervous systems, and also cytotoxins that attack your cells. And we had different levels of complexity. So some of them we wanted to specifically neutralize one toxin that is present in the monocle cobra of India. And that did that very well. For the cytotoxin, for instance, we were able to see that we were able to neutralize cytotoxins from, I think, 7 or 8 different cobras in sub-Saharan Africa, because all of these toxins are quite similar across them. So there's a range, and we're now working further on how do we neutralize as many toxins as possible with as few of these therapeutic mini binders as we can.
In the paper you mentioned, and I hadn't appreciated the number, that there's something like 100,000 fatalities from snake bites around the world every year.
Yeah, so these estimates are quite hard to get, but official numbers also by the WHO estimated to be around 100, 150,000 fatalities and about 300,000 people that are permanently disabled every year.
I mean, do you think this approach will mean that antivenoms will be available across the world in difficult-to-reach rural parts of the world much more easily? I mean, could it really make a difference?
that is my genuine hope. I've been fascinated with snake bites since I was 4, and I've been working with antivenoms for many, many years now, and this is the whole reason why we're in this. It's not just a technological showcase, but the aim is to help provide products that can go on the market at low cost and go to those most in need. And that's why we've taken a very much an engineering approach of seeing how do we not just make something cool, but something that can work in real life in a real world setting. So yeah, my belief is that it really can make a difference, and we hope that we can see that in the next few years.
Was there a point at which you suddenly saw what David Baker was doing using AI and protein design that you suddenly said, hang on, this is the approach? Did you, get on the phone or fire off an email at some point?
Yeah, there's actually quite a funny story. I was in India at the time at a friend's wedding and traveling with another friend who's a postdoc at MIT and also co-author on this paper, Thomas Fryer. And we saw this preprint of the tool RF diffusion published on BioArchive. And we saw this and couldn't believe it. It looked too good to be true. And we decided after a few beers that nothing would hurt. We could just write an email and suggest to David Baker that maybe we should be looking at snakebite with this because it would be the ideal solution for this problem. And so we sent an email to David Baker and Joe Watson, the first author of this paper. And within a day, we got a response, a very positive response. And we started conversations how to start a project collaboration. So yeah, there was this eureka moment on a beach in Goa in India. And it's quite nice to look back at that and see how far we've come since.
Tim Jenkins of the Technical University of Denmark. Go to Nature for all the details. A reminder, this is Science in Action from the BBC. The bombing in September 2022 of 4 natural gas pipelines under the Baltic Sea was a major political and diplomatic incident. But it was also an environmental one. The methane that then bubbled up to the surface is a powerful, if short-lived, greenhouse gas in desperate need of controls. But despite immediate efforts to measure the release, it's taken over 2 years to come up with a definite figure. The exercise, led by Stephen Harris for the International Methane Emissions Observatory, concluded that the incident represents, quote, the largest recorded amount of methane released from a single transient event. Though he says the lessons are more nuanced.
I guess what we concluded in our study was that about up to 485,000 metric tons of methane was released from the leaks. That's actually
Half a million, I call that.
Yeah, half a million. Let's round it up. And this actually makes it about 4 to 5 times larger than the previous largest human-caused leak. And that happened at the Aliso Canyon gas storage facility in the US. And that actually lasted for about 3 months, whereas in this case, the leaks really only lasted for about 1 week. Although I guess half a million kind of sounds like quite a lot, but when we put this in perspective, it really only just represents about 0.1% of human-caused global methane emissions, and really only equal to about 2 days of the global oil and gas industry's methane emissions. So it really kind of highlights the numerous other sources that require mitigation globally.
I mean, that's quite interesting in a way that, it's caught so much attention, the events, and there are good political reasons for that to be the case. But on the other hand, we'll come back to this, the ongoing leaks just don't get the same kind of attention. There were these three pipelines that were ruptured by explosions under the Baltic Sea.
Yes.
And as I understand it, they weren't actually carrying methane at the time, but they were pumped full of it. Is that right?
Right. They're actually not in operation, but they were fully pressurized with natural gas. And so that natural gas contains predominantly methane. So there was certainly quite a lot of methane in there that could have been released.
So that all just came out how quickly? With a matter of hours, days, weeks?
Right. So what we found was that those emissions actually lasted for about 1 week. In the early stages, they certainly released at quite a high emission rate. So I think in the early minutes to hour of the explosion, we were modeling that the leak sites were releasing about over 1,000 tons of methane per hour in those early minutes. But that gradually decreased over the period of about a week.
So it's sort of slowly,
correct.
As the pressure went down, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And it was kind of really at these later stages that we're able to measure it using atmospheric measurement techniques.
As I understand it, there was a pretty quick effort to get ships out there to make measurements using satellites. But, you know, I mean, this was seen as a very important thing for your project.
Yeah, certainly. So there are a lot of different measurement approaches that we used that included marine-based technologies like underwater submersibles and data measured on board research vessels and ferries. And we also had aircraft-based measurements, some of which were using a helicopter-based measurement system called Helipod. And these were flown near the leak sites to fully understand emissions from the event. And I guess having this many different measurement approaches was really important because there were quite a lot of different aspects to the leaks that potentially aren't appreciated that much by the public. So as the methane was emitted from the pipelines, it was transported through the water column, and some of the methane was dissolved in the Baltic Sea and eventually moved by ocean currents away from the leak sites. And there also would have been some sea surface outgassing of this dissolved methane in the broader vicinity of the leaks as well. So this actually made it quite a complex equation to solve in terms of understanding the true atmospheric budget. And so we really needed to bring data from different measurement approaches to really understand what happened.
And you mentioned that some of the methane gets dissolved in the seawater in the process. I mean, I was quite curious, firstly, you know, did most of it come out in the atmosphere, or is a lot of it still in the water? And I also recall when the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster happened in the Gulf of Mexico, that a lot of it ended up as bacteria food. Mm. Was any of this eaten, or did it all basically just make its way into the atmosphere?
Right, so what we were actually able to find was that most of the methane was emitted to the atmosphere. So only about 10,000 metric tons was dissolved in the Baltic Sea. And so that really means that, you know, the vast majority of the methane was emitted to the atmosphere. And as you correctly point out, in the Deepwater Horizon, it was kind of the other way around. So a lot of that methane was trapped in the deep ocean. There was a lot of time for bacteria to kind of consume that methane, and not a lot reached the atmosphere. But in this case, the leaks were quite shallow. So they're only about 80 meters below the sea surface. And a lot of that methane was able to escape really quickly into the atmosphere.
And it sounds like even though it was a large amount in a pulse, you were saying that actually on the grand scheme of the way that we deal with methane, this is a small deal.
Exactly. And really kind of highlights, you know, the challenges that we still face globally in reducing methane, and just how many other methane sources there are that we need to kind of tackle.
And as we've heard previously on the program, reducing methane emissions would be an easy, quick win in the battle against global warming. Is anyone paying attention? Stephen Harris there is based at the University of New South Wales. And if you detected crashes in the background, that was a classic Australian thunderstorm in progress outside. Finally, to the outer edges of the solar system, to Pluto. No longer designated a planet, just one of thousands of objects in the Kuiper Belt. Though it is orbited by another Kuiper Belt object, its own moon, Charon. The pairing has a lot in common with our planet and its moon. We got our moon 4.5 billion years ago when a protoplanet dubbed Theia smashed into the young Earth. Earth grew a little, and the moon grew out of the molten wreckage that was flung into orbit at the time. The encounter between Pluto and Charon was way more romantic and began, according to modelling by Adine Denton, with a gentle kiss.
When it comes to Pluto and Charon, they're much smaller and they're made of different materials. So they're made of an icy outer mantle and then an inner rocky core, as opposed to the Earth and the Moon, which have an outer rocky mantle and a metallic core. So they're smaller and they're also less massive. And because of that, the collision, we thought, might be a little bit different. So you might not be able to apply the same physical principles. So as part of the simulations that we did revisiting these collisions, we added in basically what we call a strength model, which is just a way of telling Pluto and Charon to behave like geologic objects. So when they hit each other, the ice should respond to that event like ice should, and same with the rock. And we found that when we did that, the way the collision happened and how Charon got captured as Pluto's moon changed completely. And the essence of what happens is Charon comes in, collides with Pluto, and then the two bodies actually partially merge and start rotating as a single large body that looks kind of like a snowman. But because they retain their integrity after the impact, they stay independent. And eventually Pluto is able to push Charon back off, and Charon then establishes itself as a satellite.
I mean, it's sort of like two dancers meeting on a ballroom, maybe, to an extent, that they sort of, they hold on to each other.
They do.
Just at the beginning, and then their motion just pulls them apart again.
Yes, and it like with dancers and the way that dancers spin, a lot of it has to do with the angular momentum of the system. So the way that Pluto is spinning prior to Charon's collision with it is what enables this whole process. And as Pluto and Charon then spin together, Pluto essentially releases Charon back out into orbit.
So this is very different. When the moon was formed, I think the standard picture is that, yeah, these two bodies smash together at high speed. The moon just sort of gets broken up, or what was, you know, what came before the moon just gets broken up. It gets thrown into orbit around the Earth. And then over the next, I can't remember, months or years, it sort of rebuilds itself. Charon in this is always sort of there. It's just that it, for a moment, it shares its identity with Pluto.
Exactly. And the reason for that is because, like I said, Pluto and Charon are smaller and less massive. And that changes the initial conditions of the impact, because the speed at which the two bodies collide, when it's two bodies that are similar in size, is dictated less by the incoming velocity of, say, Charon coming in to hit Pluto, and more by the actual mutual gravitation of the system. So because they're both smaller, they have less gravity. And so the actual collision takes place at a much smaller velocity. And in this case, it's around 1 kilometer per second. So slower than your average fighter jet.
Wow. And I guess that the conditions, you know, this is right at the edge of the solar system, the Kuiper Belt. So there's all kinds of things of this kind of size drifting around in remote solar orbit. And every now and again, they're going slowly, but some of them may come up and sort of just touch each other like this.
Quite so. It's a lot less likely now because things have gotten quite spread out. But in the early solar system, say in the first tens of millions of years after the solar system began to form, nobody's orbits were quite set yet. So there was more of a chance for one orbit to cross another and then deviate one body onto a colliding course with another.
It's a kind of three-dimensional orbiting billiards that was going on.
Yes, it is a bit. It was both very chaotic and also took quite a bit of time to happen, right? The planetary collision stage of the formation of the solar system did take place over millions of years, where nothing would happen, and then, ooh, here comes a very big impact where everything's going to change very rapidly in a matter of hours, and then, you know, everything goes quiet again for a bit. It's very quick, geologically speaking, but if you were to sit around and wait, you might be a bit bored.
And this actual kiss that you're talking about, how long did that last?
The kiss, which is what we're calling the temporary merger of Pluto and Charon. Charon comes in, collides with Pluto, and then they co-rotate for about 10 to 15 hours, and they slowly separate. And then Charon is established as Pluto's satellite by around 30 hours after the initial impact. So very geologically rapid.
That's astonishingly quick.
Yes. It's a delicate balance of just going fast enough to hit Pluto and then get stuck in the system. But I do want to note that it's actually not that uncommon. As we note in the paper, there's actually, we've been able to reproduce a Pluto and Charon-like system at least 14 times under a variety of conditions. So as long as it's going slow enough and coming in at the right angle, which is a fair bit of range, this can happen. And it could happen for some of the other Kuiper Belt objects that also have large moons.
Dean Denton, astronomer at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory in Arizona. I've put the simulation of Pluto's kiss and separation on my Blue Sky account and my account at the other place, at Peace Roland, because, well, it's just very lovely. There's lots of other science at the Science in Action webpage at bbcworldservice.com. And with that, with thanks to you for listening and to producer Alex Mansfield for bringing it all together, it's time for us to part. Till next time.